tonight on Arena. The star of 24 and designated survivor, Kiefer Sutherland, talks to us about his third music album, Bloor Street. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Kiefer Sutherland has been a movie star since he was a young man, with hits such as Stand By Me, The Lost Boys, Young Guns and Flatliners. He went on to star alongside Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men and lent his intense voice to the movie Phone Booth with Colin Farrell. He was also one of the first movie stars to make the successful transition to TV with his portrayal of Jack Bauer, the counter-terrorist agent, in the enormously successful series 24. Kiefer is, of course, the son of Donald Sutherland, but found fame in his own right with all these memorable roles. His life, however, went somewhat off the rails, and he has three spells in prison to show for it. But Kiefer Sutherland is also a musician, singer and songwriter, and has now released his third album, Bloor Street, named after the main street in his hometown of Toronto. I'll be talking to Kiefer in a few minutes after we hear the title track from the album. This is Bloor Street.
Steel on steel, I can hear the wheels of a streetcar pass me by. She whispers, "Baby,
is Bloor Street, the title track from Kiefer Sutherland's third album. Kiefer, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Bloor Street is in part a trip back in time to your hometown of Toronto. Why did you return now in your third album to Toronto and Bloor Street?
I was shooting a television show called Designated Survivor, and we were shooting it in Toronto, where I grew up. And we were there for 3 years, and it had been the longest time I had been back home where my mom and my sister live since maybe I was 16 years old. And I was walking down Bloor Street, which is the main thoroughfare that goes east to west through the city. And I came to the intersection of Bloor Street and Yonge Street, which is the largest thoroughfare going north and south. And I realized that on those four corners, all of my firsts happened. My first job was as a short order cook in the food court at the Hudson Bay Center. My first meaningful kiss with a girl was in front of the subway station at Bloor Street. The first time I ever busked with a guitar on a corner was at that corner. So many different firsts that I'd had that helped me get from kind of a boy to a young man happened there. And I'm at the time in my life where I get kind of very nostalgic about certain things. And so I wanted to write a song about this city that I came from, that I feel so lucky to have been able to grow up there, because there was a kind of freedom then that I certainly know my children and my grandchildren did not get to experience. I was 11 years old and I was on the subway with my friends going downtown every weekend. If I saw an 11-year-old on a subway right now, I would think something was seriously wrong if they were on their own. So I just think it was a great time and a great city. And I was just having a nostalgic moment about it.
Well, you say it's nostalgic, but it's also heartfelt. And really, the whole album has a rock and roll, R&B, a hint of country, fabulous ballads. But it's a very positive record. Is it coming from a positive place in your life?
Well, it's funny. My reaction to the pandemic, which I know is a horrible time, a difficult time for so many people, everybody around the world. But it was an interesting moment for me, because I don't think I had been home for more than 2 or 3 weeks at a time in over a decade. And all of a sudden, I'm home for a year. And it gave me time to really reflect on my own life and how fortunate I am to have had the career that I have, how much I love and miss my family and friends. And so the songs that I wrote during that period were really about joy and just grateful and thankfulness for the life that I've been able to lead. So songs like So Full of Love, Two Stepping in Time, Lean Into Me, are songs that if you had told me I was going to write 4 years ago, I would have laughed, because I have a tendency to be a little sarcastic and maybe pessimistic. But the truth is, I mean, I just had a moment, and these songs were an expression of gratitude and gratefulness, and I hope that translates to the listener. It certainly helped me as a writer.
Yes, Two Stepping in Time is one of the songs I picked out. I think it's a beautiful love song. It's like, yes, it's a dance between two people. How did it come about?
A friend of mine who I was recording demos with had said, you know, I really think you need to write a waltz. And I picked up a guitar and I started kind of working on a melody for that. And the lyric that I came up with, kind of the beginning, which was Two Stepping in Time, it just worked better in a 4-4 measure as opposed to a 6-8 kind of signature. And so I started writing that, and I was going through a time where I really wanted to utilize as a writer what was in front of me. I didn't need to reach into the depths of my imagination because there was so much there. And so the first couple lines, cigarettes in the ashtrays, all in a line, empty glasses of whiskey, show the passage of time. They were right in front of me. I had my cigarettes and I had my whiskey and I was playing the guitar. I have since quit smoking for almost a year now, so it lets you know how long old the song is. And my girlfriend was sitting, you know, a couple chairs down. And so I just started writing the song to her. And luckily for me, the song kind of really wrote itself in a very short period of time. I love playing that song. On the album, it's kind of rocked up a bit, and you've got the kind of the eighth notes guitar part at the beginning, which reminds me of, you know, the Cars and the Knack of the late 70s. But the original version is kind of almost a Mexican influenced kind of almost mariachi kind of flavor when I would play it on acoustic guitar. So it's funny to see, for me, you know, I'll write a song, but by the time the band gets through with it, what it ultimately becomes. Two Stepping in Time was just literally, again, just slowing down enough to kind of take a moment to tell my partner how much she meant to me.
Cigarettes in the ashtrays, all in a line, empty glasses of whiskey, show the passage of time.
That's Two Stepping in Time, sung there by Kiefer Sutherland from his album Bluer Street. Kiefer, I was interested in what you were talking about there, how you write the songs, because the songs are very evocative. Obviously, there's the title track, but so many of the songs, like Chasing Rain, for example, which is about life on the road. Do you use any of your actor skills to inhabit songs like you would a part?
No, and it's such a great question because, you know, I do remember after the first record thinking, well, you know, I mean, I've performed on stage and in front of cameras my whole life. I think the touring thing should be pretty comfortable. And oh my God, was I so wrong. All of a sudden I'm standing in front of 400 perfect strangers and I'm telling them this intimate kind of private moment about my life and why I wrote this song and something I wouldn't even share with, you know, a casual acquaintance, let alone a stranger. And I kind of miscalculated because as an actor, you inhabit a character. And all of a sudden, for the first time, I'm standing on stage and I'm trying to explain what it's like to be me. And I felt incredibly vulnerable. And I do remember my hands starting to shake, which as a guitar player is not helpful. And so it took me a minute to adjust to that. But when I did, when I finally started to feel comfortable sharing those kinds of moments, the exchange that I would have with an audience was something that I had never experienced before.
And you never thought of putting on a persona to perform? Was it because those songs were you and you couldn't fake it to be someone else?
It would have defeated the point. I think what I find interesting about using music in a way of communicating is that it is going to kind of be a much more personal expression for me than that of a character. Jack Bauer, one of the most enjoyable times of my career for 10 years. That's a character. In no way, shape, or form am I Jack Bauer. And it's a great character play, and it's a lot of fun to do that. But the music for me is an opportunity to kind of say, this is who I am. This is what I'm going through. And maybe you've got a similar experience. For instance, a song that I wrote about the passing of my mom, a song called Saskatchewan that I was, I could play. And in the third row, I would see a woman with her friend, and her friend would put her arm around her. And immediately I would know that young lady, sadly has lost her mom or dad recently as well. And so you start building these kinds of small connections with the audience on a personal level in a way that I've never experienced. And so that's the joy that I get from it. And that also helps make it a very different kind of experience for me than that of as an actor.
One of the most evocative songs, I thought, was the County Jail Gate. And I think this kind of refers back to your maybe bad boy days when you did spend some time in prison. But it was the imagery you use of the jail gate. I just wondered why you say 2 tons of steel grinding on wheels as though, the gate closed and that was the end of your life for a period of time.
Because that's how heavy those gates are. And sadly, I can tell you, I've seen more than one. And it's just a moment that, clearly by the time you're in this position, you've done something pretty stupid. You're kind of humiliated and you're embarrassed. But nothing brings it home more than when that gate starts to screech and it makes an awful noise and the buzzers are ringing and the lights are flashing as they open it so that all the guards are attentive so that no one accidentally walks out.
And fearful.
And everything...
Terrifying.
Everything slow. Oh, it's awful. And everything slows down. And it's like there's a flashing light above your head that just says idiot. And there's just nothing cool about it. And so there's a line in the song, wasted time's what's on my mind because this ain't no way to live. Those are the reflective kind of moments that you have in that situation when you just go, this can't happen again. I can't allow this to happen again. And you need to do something to straighten your life out. And luckily for me, I have a great support network with family and friends, and I made some adjustments. But I think for me, writing the song was really important because there's also comes a time when you have to kind of put it behind you. You can't wear it everywhere you go and just beat yourself up to a pulp for, it's been 15 years. And somehow writing that song helped me kind of put it in an envelope and send it on its way.
Do you think that huge early success you had with films like Young Guns and Flatliners, that gave you the confidence in your own ability to continue with your successful career? Or was it a huge pressure on you as you grew older and had to go through the growing up process that everybody has to go through, no matter how famous you are?
Well, for me, it was kind of neither. I was so young that I just assumed this is how it went. I had a very successful father and a very successful mother as actors. And I was, I certainly knew that it wasn't all down to me. Filmmaking is a real team sport. And I got very lucky to be in a few films from Stand By Me to A Few Good Men that all worked. And so I just thought, well, okay, this is really cool. This is what I'm going to get to do. But by the time I hit kind of my later 20s, like anything else, directors and producers and audiences wanted to see something new. And so as fast as it kind of all happened, it went away. And that's when the real education begins. It's always in the valleys. It's never on the peaks, right? And that's when I think I got, you know, I think I became a much better actor through that time period. I certainly think I became a better person and just started trying to get to a place where I wasn't going to take things for granted. And I also started to kind of really enjoy life. It was not just about work. I think I started rodeoing and working with horses at that time and just developed other interests and then got very lucky with something like 24. I think the one thing I've always known is that I do feel very capable as an actor, but I couldn't necessarily tell you why one film is successful and another fails. I don't have that power. And so I think of it very much like work. You know, you're very lucky to have it. And not one job is kind of more precious than another. You just do the best you can.
When you did 24, that transition from film to television was not fashionable like it is now. Did you see that as a big risk taking on 24? Or was the role of Jack Bauer just too intoxicating?
I couldn't afford to think of it in any term. I needed the work. And the offers that I was getting in the television world were more interesting and better put together than the offers I was getting in the film world. Again, I was grateful to have a job. And again, had no idea that 24 was going to become what it would ultimately become, which was kind of, I remember seeing a review when 24 first came out. And I knew certainly things weren't going as well as they had gone at one time in my life. But the review said, back from the dead, Kiefer Sutherland. And I was like, wow, it wasn't that bad. But, you know, so I just, again, it was an opportunity that I, again, just so grateful to have had. And really one of the most exciting kind of 10 years of my life as an actor, just because I love that crew and I love the character. And it was so nice to do something that people were enjoying.
Was that when you started writing songs then during 24?
I started writing songs. I had a small music label with a fantastic artist and producer named Jude Cole. And we had a lot of artists kind of coming through our doors. And everybody had a different way of writing. Right. Some people were kind of really had to have a melody before they could start to write. And some people, they would go for a title or a hook in a chorus. And, you know, everybody had their own thing. And I was always interested by writing and I always had written. But for me, it would feel like the earth had to part, you know, or the skies had to part and the song would fall out of the sky into my lap. And ooh, gosh, that was lucky. And I started kind of cherry picking techniques from these different artists that were coming through our door and just really as an exercise, started kind of putting some things together. And all of a sudden the songs that I was writing, I had more control over and I started to like them. And it was Jude Cole who really suggested that we record some of them, and one thing led to another and we made an album. So it wasn't one morning I woke up and said, this is what I'm going to do. It was a really gradual process. But during 24, I wrote a lot because I was at work 5 days a week. I was there 12 to 14 hours a day. And there's a lot of downtime for actors on movie sets and television sets for the cameras to readjust. And so I was always playing guitar. And then at this time, I started to write.
So you're going to be back on television, is it, playing Franklin D. Roosevelt?
Yes, it's a limited series. It's called The First Lady, and it chronicles the lives and point of view of three prominent first ladies who changed America's perception of what the office of the first lady was. And so Viola Davis plays Michelle Obama, Michelle Pfeiffer plays Betty Ford, and Gillian Anderson plays Eleanor Roosevelt, and I play Franklin Roosevelt to her Eleanor.
That's a very exciting prospect. I hope we'll be seeing that soon.
Yes, that's going to come out in April, and it's the first time I had been asked to do a historical character, and he's you know, when I would do interviews for Designated Survivor, I would always say Franklin Roosevelt was my favorite American president. So to have the opportunity to not only study him in greater depth, but to play him as an actor was just a huge, huge opportunity for me. And I can't wait for people to see it.
We were going to go out on Chasing the Rain. Would you introduce that for us, please, Kiefer?
Well, yes, Chasing the Rain is, I've been wanting to write a song about the kind of joys of touring that I have experienced. And I had a couple stabs at it, and it never worked. And we were doing a tour from January through March in Europe. And it seemed every place we played, it rained. Even if we had a sunny forecast, by the time we rolled into town, the skies would open up and the rain would start coming. And I remember saying to one of my bandmates, oh my gosh, it's like we're just chasing the rain. And I thought, oh, a little light bulb went off. And the song actually wrote itself quite quickly. So this is a song that I love about and moments that I love about touring, and it's called Chasing the Rain.
Kiefer Sutherland, thank you so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Mile after mile, we're just chasing the rain. Night after night, we're just chasing the rain.
You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Since it first appeared on Broadway in 1987, Into the Woods remains one of the late Stephen Sondheim's most popular musicals. It takes four fairy tales, Cinderella, Rapunzel, Jack and the Beanstalk and Little Red Riding Hood, and asks what might have happened before Once Upon a Time and after Happily Ever After. Northern Irish Opera opens a new production of the musical at the Lyric Theatre Belfast next week, starring Sean Kearns as the narrator and mysterious man, and directed by Cameron Menzies. Let's set the scene with the opening number or prologue of Into the Woods from the film version in 2014.
Once upon a time, in a far-off kingdom, there lay a small village at the edge of the woods. And in this village,
more than anything,
lived a young maiden,
more than life, more than jewels,
a carefree young lad.
I wish more than life,
and a childless baker.
I wish
with his wife, more than anything,
more than the moon.
I wish
the king is giving a festival.
More than life,
I wish. I wish to go to the festival.
More than riches,
in a bowl.
I wish my cow would give us some milk.
More than anything,
I wish we had a child.
I want a child. I wish to go to the festival.
I wish to give us
some milk. I wish we might have a child. I wish.
You wish to go to the festival.
The poor girl's parents had died.
You, Cinderella, the festival.
Well, you wish to go to the festival.
The festival. The king's festival.
And now she lived with her stepmother.
The festival.
So that's the opening number or prologue of Into the Woods from the film version in 2014. You heard the voices of Anna Kendrick there as Cinderella and James Corden as the narrator and baker. But in the Northern Irish Opera version, you will hear Sean Kearns as the narrator and mysterious man. And Cameron Menzies, you will not hear him, but he is the director of this very ambitious production. And Cameron Menzies and Sean Kearns join me now. Cameron, this is a very timely production given the recent death of Stephen Sondheim. Were you always a big fan of his work?
Hello, yes, always. I mean, his works are so wonderful and so witty and clever and so human. And I think now is a perfect time. I mean, we had planned this before his sad death, but it really is a perfect time to produce his works because they're so human and they're so look, you know, they're all searching for something, which I think is a very apt thing to be looking at the moment.
Now, Sean, you played the narrator, and there at the beginning, I think we heard it, James Corden doing it, you're introducing the various characters from the various fairy tales. So could you just give us that opening scenario and how they all pack off into the woods as succinctly as you will on stage?
Well, basically, yes. Hello there.
Hello there.
Yes. So I basically introduce every single one of the fairy tale characters. So, for instance, at the very start, you're introduced to Cinderella. You're introduced to Jack from Jack and the Beanstalk and his mother. And you're introduced to a character called the Baker and his wife, who are a childless couple. And then I gradually introduce other characters to steer them in the correct path to get what they wish and what they, or what they think they wish and what they think they may desire.
Now, Cameron, I can see so many challenges in this because it has been made into a film. So there's all kinds of CGI and wonderful ways to make things look, not to mind how things can sound. So there are so many challenges. You've the actors, you've the music, and then you have the look. How have you approached all three?
with great care, really, across all of it. But look, we haven't set the piece specifically in Northern Ireland, but it does have a very Celtic feel. We have a wonderful designer called Niall McKeever, who's actually from Enniskillen, and he has brought such a wonderful sort of Celtic flavour through the piece. And I think people will see their very, you know, favourite Grimm's tales, fairy tales characters, but they're sort of put through a slightly Celtic lens, which I think is a really interesting way to look at this piece at the moment.
There are woods, presumably.
There are woods. Yes, we have woods. While we don't have necessarily, trees growing from the ground, we have a beautiful set that absolutely encapsulates the woods and the metaphor of what the woods are and about these people moving through chaos into these new areas, which is effectively represent the woods.
The role of narrator then, Sean, is, are you really just pushing the action on, filling in on the narrative, or are you involved in the action as well?
Well, it's interesting, yes. So as the narrator, yes, I do exactly as it says on the tin, and I inform the audience as to what is happening, oblivious to all of the characters on stage. And then the flip of that is the mysterious man who, in a way, is possibly an extension of the narrator, but he enters the world of the fairy tale characters and he becomes visible. And that version of him becomes visible. And again, he throws spanners in the works and he, you know, asks them questions and interacts with them and provokes them or distracts them. You know, so that's really, really interesting.
So we heard there, Cameron, of people, the characters saying that they wish. So there's the Jack of the Beanstalk's mother wishing for something. Then there's the Cinderella's ugly sisters wishing for something. What is Sondheim saying about people who are ambitious or who are looking for a different life?
It's a really interesting theme that runs through the piece, and I think it takes us from characters that are very myopic and very one focused on one path, and that's what they wish for, and that's what they strive for. And then in Act Two, it sort of knocks them all off their courses, and people realise that there are more paths than just the one path that they've lived on for this period. And I think what Sondheim is looking at is that you might think you know where you're headed in life, but life interrupts that and knocks you onto another path. But that may not be a bad thing. You know, you might find compassion. You might find a new way of thinking about something, and that this idea of just one path in life is very limiting. And I think that's what the characters discover through the piece as well.
So fairy tales, like a lot of stories for children, rely on absentee or flawed parents. And it's, I think, a regular theme in Sondheim's work as well. He had famously difficult relationships with his mother, didn't he?
A very difficult relationship, yes. And pretty much to the point where she had told him at a time that she never wanted him. So in this piece, that maternal image is very, very prominent as well. And I think looking at all the different mothers throughout the piece, I think it almost is all the different facets of what a woman can be as a mother. It very much looks at parenting children as well, and how careful you have to be in that pursuit. And I think that very much reflects back to Sondheim's personal life and with his mother.
Sean, Northern Irish acting is having quite a moment at the moment with the success of Belfast. And you have worked on the West End. You're a very successful jobbing actor. Do you find that doors are opening for, or is there a specific Northern Irish type of actor or style of acting?
Well, you know, I think it's very important to always remember who you are and where you've come from, but that shouldn't limit you to just being that. And the more experiences that you can have outside your environment, the richer I think you're going to be. You know, and it's interesting. You were asking earlier about people what they want and what they wish, and there's a beautiful sort of sequence where Cinderella goes to the grave of her mother and she says, "I wish," and her mother says, "Do you know what you wish? Are you certain that you wish is what you want?" And it's that whole question of be careful what you want, you know. But for me, I am, as you said, rightly said, a jobbing actor, and I have spent my entire career literally going from pillar to post, from every sort of style of acting. I've done farce, I've done comedy, I've done tragedy, and that's the joy, you know, of getting to stretch and exercise all of those different sort of acting muscles that you wouldn't necessarily get if you stayed put in the one place.
And Cameron, how are you settling into Belfast? You are the artistic director of Northern Irish Opera. Have you many wonderful new plans for them?
Yes, it's been wonderful. I've been here just over a year now, and now that life is coming back and you know, things are opening up more and more, it's really wonderful. And you know, this, we have done work since I arrived, but this is the first time we've been able to step back into a theatre. So we're in the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, and it's such a... I went down there the other day just to have a look in there because I've never worked there before, and it's such a joy to step back into that building and to a theatre, to be able to bring a theatre... and a production into a theatre is so exciting, and it makes your imagination and your mind run wild.
Absolutely. Well, the best of luck to you, Cameron Menzies and Sean Kearns. Into the Woods is at the Lyric Theatre Belfast from the 3rd to the 27th of February. Further details from lyrictheatre.co.uk. Coming up to 12 minutes to 8, James Birch has been a promoter of modern art exhibitions both in the UK and around the world for over 30 years. He has shown such luminaries as Gilbert and George, Eileen Agar and Grayson Perry. His new book, Bacon in Moscow, describes how he achieved the seemingly impossible, taking an exhibition of Francis Bacon's work to Moscow in the late 1980s. He negotiated between the volatile artist and the Soviet bureaucracy with the help of a KGB middleman in order to exhibit the work. Francis Bacon was, of course, born in Dublin in 1909, but lived most of his life in London. His studio, 7 Rees Mews, is now on permanent display at the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin. Bacon is known for creating some of the 20th century's most evocative and challenging paintings, such as 3 studies for figures at the base of a crucifixion and a series inspired by Velázquez's portrait of Pope Innocent. I'm delighted to be joined now by James Birch. James, this is a fascinating story of a great artist, Thatcher's Britain, the USSR in transition, and your very own role in Glasnost. Can you set the scene of the London art world in the late 1980s?
Well, it's a great pleasure to meet you. And
delighted.
How fantastic you say all this stuff. That's so wonderful. And thank you. Anyway, what I was saying is what happened in the early 80s, the art was not very, people weren't interested in art at all. And I wanted to do this art show of taking these young artists to at New York at the time, but I went to a party. They said, "Don't take them to New York, take them to Moscow." I said, "Well, how do I do that?" And I said, "Well, just go to the Soviet section of UNESCO and ask for Sergei Klokov, and he'll do it. And that's exactly what happened.
Right, and this Sergei Klokov was this... well, what was he? You found out him to be a KGB agent, but presumably that's not what you thought he was when you met him first.
To be honest, you're absolutely right. When I met him, I thought he was a very nice guy. You know, he had this Pierre Gardin suits on. He had Pierre Gardin trousers. He had a Pierre Gardin man bag. And he just looked like some bloke, like a hairdresser, actually, to be honest. And but the fact is, he was an unbelievable apparatchik. That, if you know what that means at that time, these guys would do things. And you've got to remember, there's a photograph of Sergei Klokov as an 11-year-old boy next door to Yuri Gagarin, who was the first man who went round the moon, who's probably the most famous man in the world at that time. So it's extraordinary.
So the first person you had in mind was Andy Warhol, but that didn't work out because Andy didn't travel. So then you on chatting to the arts community and artists in Moscow, you realised that Francis Bacon was much more, well, their cup of tea, or at least they found him an interesting artist. And you used to hang out in Soho. Did you hang out in the same, let's say, in the Colony Club and or a room club in Soho? Or did you know Francis Bacon?
I knew Francis Bacon as a child. I mean, literally as a child. There's a photograph in this book, which I hope you must buy, that it's got me as a child. And they said, what on earth is Francis Bacon taking me a photograph of me as a child? But my mother, parents, thought they were absolutely no problem at all. They just liked to do it. And in fact, when you see the book, if you haven't seen the book...
I have it in front of me.
I look astonished, don't I? Like a Francis Bacon painting, in a funny way.
And then you were, through your Russian agent, you went to Russia and you got permission, or they invited you, or they decided they wanted to invite Bacon for this exhibition. But then, of course, you had to go and try and convince Francis Bacon. How did he take the invitation? Or how did you put the invitation to him?
Oh, Francis was so brilliant, though. I mean, because I've known him from as a child. I mean, he had a trust in me. And, you know, I bumped into him from whatever. And so when a bit of a period of time came, I had to open my gallery in Dean Street. And he came in. I had a British pop-up exhibition. He said, oh, let's go for dinner. And literally, we went for dinner down the corner of Dean Street. I said, by the way, Francis, would you like to have a show in Moscow? He went, what? Why not? He was fed up with people, all this criticism from people in America saying, you know, lumps of shit, lumps of beef, etc. So he said yes. And in fact, I said, okay, Francis, I'll ring you tomorrow and see if you agree on that. And the next day I rang him, and he was rather irritated that I actually rang him, because he thought he meant it then. But I mean, I was just checking, because in those days, I have to say to you, to ring a telephone call to Moscow was 5 hours. You had to be checked out 5 hours. And so, you know, how difficult was that?
So getting the work over then, I mean, you're talking about, like, I'm looking, they're the paintings in the back of your book. So they're top of the range Bacons you're taking over.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how difficult was that? I'm thinking of transportation, insurance, then securing the gallery. Like, how big a task was that?
This was very difficult. And in fact, to be honest, you... was not really part of my priority. In fact, the British Council, when they came along, and said they would pay for it, and they were absolutely brilliant. They said they would pay for it, they would export it, and everything else. So I have to thank them for that.
And then Sergei Klokov, how involved was he? Like, he was dealing with you, but then he'd kind of go behind your back and deal with Bacon and deal. So there was all kind of crisscrossing about.
Well, of course he went behind my back. So basically, when I needed a holiday. I went to India, and Klokov came to town, and he went to see Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon took him out for lunch. And it's a very difficult one. I don't know what to say. I mean, maybe Francis found Plokhov with his, you know,
Pierre Cardin bag.
Or burning villages with flamethrowers and whatever. Maybe he found him attractive. I don't know. I don't know. But, you know, Francis Bacon was a difficult character.
Yes, that's what we hear. Whereas your relationship with him, he was very sociable, very charming, but obviously a bit duplicitous in his dealings with you.
Oh, totally. But all I can say to you is, bless my soul, the most amazing thing, the whole exhibition could have stopped, but it didn't stop, and it happened, even though he didn't come to him. And that's a sadness. That's a real sadness.
Explain why he didn't come. Because at one stage he seems like very enthusiastic about going, yes, because he wanted to look at the, you know, the famous art treasures in Russia.
He wanted to come, but his person, who is called David Sylvester, who wrote about him a lot, and even though Francis Bacon, I will say this on record, Francis Bacon said he's the most lousy person about art. Anyway, David Sylvester said, "Oh, Francis, if you go to Moscow, you'll probably get, because you're a rather rich person, you'll get kidnapped. If you want to go to Leningrad in those days, you'll probably get kidnapped or whatever." So Francis, and you've got to remember, he was an older man, said no. And I can sort of understand that.
And was there any problem with the, I think it was the Russian Visual Arts Union and the people you were negotiating with? Did they have, were they in any way censorious of the work of Francis Bacon?
No. They, amazingly enough, they loved the work. They wanted, they'd seen the work. The Dog Eared magazines, they loved the work and they wanted to see it. And in fact, it's such an extraordinary thing to have Francis Bacon in Moscow. It's so amazing. It's so amazing. And they loved it. They loved it. And no one had any complaints about it, except for the British press.
Now, you're very interesting about the way that the Russians observed his. I don't wish to put all the Russians and the Soviets in one box, but you say they got it on a level, they got his work on a level that, let's say, the English viewer or the European viewer mightn't get it.
Well, listen, the extraordinary thing is, look, if you go to the Tate Gallery and you see a Francis Bacon painting, and you might be whatever you are, whatever age, whatever. You see this painting and you might look at it for 5 minutes. But in Russia, these guys, men and women, have not seen a painting from the West for a whole life. To see this painting was so extraordinary. It was absolutely gobsmacked by them. And they looked at it for 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. That's what changed my life.
Yes, and then you had become so, you know, you had visited Moscow an awful lot, and you had seen the workings of glasnost and perestroika and all the changes that were happening then. Were they obvious, or was it still, you know, teeming with KGB agents like the one you met?
No, it was very weird, because when I first went there, you have these, you know, big, which I quite love, you know, those big hammer and sickle flags, seeing peace of the world, etc. And then when I went back again, suddenly it was like, that had gone and said, no more vodka for people.
Oh, right, so, yes, they had stopped so in that sense, selling booze, yes.
And I loved all, you know, as you love yourself, that fabulous, all that sort of crazy hammer and sickle stuff.
The book is fascinating, and there's all the paintings are there at the back. James Birch, it's been a pleasure talking to you. The book is called Bacon in Moscow.